You know, I knew exactly what he was doing. It was alpha male writ large. You want to know what a president looks like? This is what a president looks like. Not this woman.
In a new documentary, Hillary Clinton revisits the time that Donald Trump stalked her on the debate stage in 2016 and gets serious about what's at stake in this election. Plus, Steve Coogan makes a satire that wants you to think about economic inequality.
Comedy is very useful when you're trying to tell a story, because if you're trying to talk about something that you think is important, no one wants to have a lecture. But if they laugh, then they'll kind of relax a little and they'll be more open to what you've got to say.
And a lifelong Kiss fan says goodbye to the band that helped him come out of the closet. It's The Frame Weekend from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. I'm John Horn. We'll be right back. Welcome to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Coming up later in the show, he has staged opera in a train station, in moving cars, and now outdoors in a park in downtown Los Angeles. Yuval Sharon is one of the city's true art pioneers. But we'll start with Hillary Clinton. Just as the race for the Democratic nominee for president is getting a whole lot clearer, Hulu has released a documentary series about the last Democratic nominee for president.
Secretary Hillary Rodham Clinton.
The documentary was made by filmmaker Nanette Burstein, and she combined behind-the-scenes footage from the 2016 campaign with new interviews to tell the life story of Hillary Rodham Clinton. I recorded this conversation with Clinton and Burstein in front of a live audience at the Sundance Film Festival after the series premiere.
Hillary, Nanette's pitch was to interview you and other people who worked on the campaign and are close to the campaign and close to you. What was the story that you wanted to tell through those interviews that maybe the footage couldn't tell?
You know, John, I have to take my mind back to when Nanette basically proposed making this bigger than the campaign and really focusing on my life, but using my life as a springboard into the women's movement, our political system, and these other themes. And I obviously knew I'd be interviewed. I was interviewed for 35 hours. But, you know, she had free rein to interview anybody that would interview with her. And so you'll see people literally that I grew up with or that I went to high school or college or law school or that were colleagues. And then a lot of people that, you know, she chose to interview to fill in the story. So I was on board.
Were there certain people that were hard to get to go on camera? And who would you put at the top of that list? And even within that list, who are the people that really presented you with the greatest challenge in terms of how you're going to ask difficult questions?
Well, the hardest people to get were all of the conservative voices. We went out to 30, 40 people that overlapped with Secretary Clinton's life from the 90s onward, from Newt Gingrich to Lindsey Graham to even more moderate politicians like Susan Collins, Olympia Snow, and they just all said no. And, you know, and I would follow up, too, because I am not very good at taking no as an answer. And, like, for example, Newt Gingrich, who I was really, really wanted to include his voice, whatever, you know, however interesting that would have been, because he was a big part of her time as First Lady and being on the opposition and leading that charge. So we sent a letter formally, and his sister does his PR, and they, you know, very diplomatically said no, and then someone gave me his cell phone number, and I called him, and I couldn't believe he picked up. I was like, "Oh, hello! Like, you don't know who I am. You don't know this number." But and then I just launched into my pitch, and he's like, "Oh yeah, no, I know what your offer was," and he said, "I would rather stick a needle in my eye." I said, "Okay, I don't think there's a lot of convincing to be done now."
Hillary, there are so many slights in this film. It's like bleeding to death from 1,000 paper cuts. The little things that are said in passing that seem, in isolation, terrible, but in accumulation, horrific. And that's the idea of how women law students were treated at Yale. The judge who asked you to twirl around while you're at the podium. There's a line that Chris Matthews has that I won't even dignify by repeating. A TV announcer calls you the ambitious yuppie from hell. All of those little things over the course of the documentary, to me, made a very lasting impact of what is casually said, but is so hurtful.
You're right, John. And I think Nanette did a masterful job of weaving that in, because again, it's not just about me. And the relentless belittling and demeaning and dismissing is often either ignored or absorbed in a way that you don't fully appreciate the impact of as you move through your life. So one of my concerns is, you know, you have to develop such tough skin. You don't want to be battered and hurt, broken by a constant belittlement, but you also don't want to be so impervious that you can't absorb whatever legitimate criticism might be coming your way. So very early on, I kind of developed this mantra to take criticism seriously, but not personally. That doesn't include, you know, the harassment and the insults, because that's in a different, you know, category. But a lot of the language that is still used today about women in the public arena has the same impact. And I just hope that this, I hope that this documentary, as people watch it, will spark conversations like the one we're having, so that it's not off limits to say, wait a minute, you know, why is this still part of the ongoing dialogue about women's roles and women's rights? And of course, I think we're going through a real backlash, so I think the conversation is even more important.
I don't want to quote Bart Simpson in such a serious conversation, but I'm going to.
Please do.
Bart Simpson says, and he didn't make this up, damned if you do, damned if you don't. And there's a moment in the fourth episode where you're in a debate and Donald Trump is stalking you. He's physically behind you. And in the documentary, you say in real time that you're aware that he's standing behind you. Yep. And as you're speaking about some very important issue, you're playing out all these scenarios. What would happen if I turn around? I can't, because this is how it will play. But what if I ignore him? This is how it will play. And that seems to be a constant theme throughout the documentary, that if you go one direction, people will criticize you for doing that, and another group of people will criticize you for not doing it, that you're stuck at so many points in your life that any decision is going to have a polarizing effect.
Yeah, because, you know, that word polarizing, I think about it a lot, because clearly it's often the way that I'm described. Is Newt Gingrich described as polarizing? He may be described as a lot of things, but he's hardly ever described as polarizing. And, you know, I look at these political leaders predominantly on the Republican side, and I think, well, what is so polarizing about me that it's a word that is used in practically every interview description that you can imagine? So part of the challenge I think this documentary poses to people is to say, well, wait a minute, you know, when I was taking that law school admission test that we talk about, I was with a group of young women that I went to college with, and we were in this huge lecture hall at Harvard, because that's where the test was going to be given. So we're sitting there waiting for the test to start, and the comments that were directed at us were not exclusive to me. It was, you know, what are you doing here? Why are you taking this test? If you go to law school, you'll take a place, and I won't get a deferment, and I'll go to Vietnam, and I'll be killed, and it'll be your fault. This is before we take the test, right? And so, you know, at that point in my life, I didn't respond, because I wanted to do well on the test. So put your head down, do the work. That's what all the young women at this one table where we were all sitting together all did. Today, I'd say, get a life. Get over it. Who do you think you are? Now, that would make me polarizing, right? So I think that there's so much that we're still working out. And the incident that John just referred to in that second debate, you know, I knew exactly what he was doing. You know, it was alpha male writ large. You want to know what a president looks like? This is what a president looks like. Not this woman. Not this girl. And I'm going to show you how dominant I am. And so I'm up there and I'm going, okay, I know exactly what he's doing. What do I do? Do I turn around and say, back off, you creep? I'm not intimidated by you, which I knew would have polarizing effects. And it would also raise the issue, like, you know, if she can't handle him, how's she going to handle Vladimir Putin? Well, I would add a heck of a lot better than the current guy. So, you know, because, you know, I've been in the public eye for a long time, but even before I practiced law, I tried lawsuits and all that. I have worked with and against countless men who come in all sizes and shapes, all sorts of hairstyles, and they're judged on who they are. But when a woman walks into that arena, everybody unloads on her every single feeling or reaction that they have about women in the public eye. So what I did, if those of you saw it, was do nothing. You know, just like I did back when I took the law school test. Just do the job. And hopefully people will say, hey, you know, I'd rather have somebody who is not acting like that, dealing with the serious problems we have in the world.
This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn, and you're hearing my interview with former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and filmmaker Nanette Burstein. Burstein is the director of the new Hulu documentary series Hillary. It covers all aspects of Hillary's life, including her marriage to Bill Clinton.
You know, we do spend a half hour of the series on the impeachment, the Monica Lewinsky incident, and I tried to deal with it very much from a personal perspective. And not because there's this salacious interest, but because so much of Secretary Clinton's life following that was judged in her perception, particularly if she was running for office, when she was running for Senate, when she was running in 08, and very much when she was running 16. I can't tell you the number of educated, liberal female friends of mine who would say to me, oh, I can't vote for her. She didn't leave her husband.
Hillary, what is it like watching that footage of your husband offering up his explanation, rationalization for what he did with Monica Lewinsky, and about how I think it's fair to say that you are paying the price for his sins?
Well, that's pretty dramatic. Well, I don't, you know, you couldn't have done a documentary about my life and not done a documentary about my marriage. And like every marriage I know, we've had ups and downs, but ours have all played out in public after 1992 or so. You know, it was difficult. You know, talking about it, answering questions, you know, that is, you know, not my favorite way to spend the afternoon. But I was very committed to being as forthcoming as I could be in working with Nanette, and Bill was too.
I saw you at Brian Fogel's new movie, The Dissident, about the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And a large part of that movie is about social media and about how Saudi Arabia controls the country by controlling social media. And it feels like one of the takeaways from this documentary is the ways that social media can be used and misused in an era where facts and lies are almost interchangeable. So when you think about some of the takeaways from the documentary and with this other movie fresh in your mind, how do you see a path through that, where we're living in what I think we can call a post-factual world, where you can create Twitter accounts that don't represent anybody or may actually be, you know, created by foreign governments?
I think this is one of the most important questions that we all have to try to both face and answer. We are awash in disinformation. And right now, I look at the 2020 election and I see so much of what happened in 2016 being repeated, but it's more sophisticated than it was in 2016. I think, you know, voter suppression, of course, is going on, but you know, the hacking and the weaponization of information, the false information, the propaganda, the deep fakes, which will come into their own in this election season, the not just permission, but the profiting from false advertising. It is incredibly dangerous. And this is serious stuff, and we obviously don't have a government right now that cares about it. In fact, they think it advantages them. And the tech companies seem unwilling to shoulder the full responsibility, in particular Facebook. So I'm really worried about where all this leads.
Hillary, the end of this documentary, and I'll share a personal story, left my wife and I in a spirited debate. I found it somewhat pessimistic. She found it optimistic. But in terms of what you think are the takeaways, what do you hope people take away from it? And how would you assess that optimistic, pessimistic take that my wife and I had?
That's fascinating, John. I don't want to polarize your
maybe family.
It's already polarized.
Oh, well. I remain fundamentally optimistic because I really can't believe that we're going to destroy the greatest experiment in self-government that the world has ever seen. I just can't believe that. And so I don't believe it, and therefore I wake up every day thinking about what more do we need to do to protect what has worked and to fix what has not. And so for me, I think there are several takeaways. One, I do hope that there is a debate about women's roles and women's lives and the progress we have been making, but you know, some of the remaining challenges that we face. I also hope it sparks a conversation about our politics. How did we get to the point where we literally cannot make the decisions that will protect our planet, create more economic opportunity, provide, you know, universal health care? I mean, I think we have a huge existential decision to make this November. And whoever the Democratic nominee is, get behind that person. You've got to be committed.
That was Hillary Clinton and filmmaker Nanette Burstein. Their documentary series, Hillary, is on Hulu now.
This land is your land.
Coming up, filmmaker Lee Whannell was asked for his take on The Invisible Man. He decided to make it a story about a woman. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Leading the box office last weekend was The Invisible Man. It is the latest cinematic reimagining of the classic H.G. Wells story. The film stars Elizabeth Moss as a woman who thinks she's finally free from her controlling and abusive husband when she's told that he has committed suicide. But she soon finds herself being hunted in a way that's very hard to prove.
I realized that invisibility is a great metaphor for a woman trying to prove that someone is being abusive towards her, that someone is manipulating her. Because manipulation, psychological manipulation and abuse, is invisible.
Those themes of abuse and gaslighting echo some of what the Me Too movement has brought so sharply into focus off-screen. Director and screenwriter Lee Whannell says that all came later. First, there was a casual meeting with executives at Universal Pictures.
Like, it was just like, yeah, what do you think about, you know, say, The Invisible Man? You know, is that something? And actually, one of them said, well, it's a hard character to write because if he's the good guy, who's the bad guy? And I said, well, no, he's not the good guy. He's the bad guy. And they said, so what would you do with it? And again, very nonchalant, not thinking much of it. I was like, I guess I would tell the story from the point of view of the victim. And then I finished the conversation. We shook hands. I walked out of there and I was like, well, that was a nice conversation about the weather and the Dodgers and the Invisible Man. And then it's like, you know, the phone, that was a very old school. For radio, I did the phone.
It
was very, it was a rotary phone, but that was my mobile. And it rings, it's like, bzz, bzz, that was better. And it's my agent. And he's like, So they love your take on the Invisible Man, and they really want you to do this.
And you were just making it up.
Yeah, I'm like, wait, what? And the next thing I knew, I was writing the film.
I'm going to ask you about getting inside the mind of Cecilia, Elizabeth Moss's character.
James!
Yeah, what happened? What happened? What?
I saw some things. It was right there. It was right there. There were footprints. I saw it.
You saw footprints?
Yes, I saw on the sheets. I saw it right there. I saw them.
Well, when I'm writing screenplays, I don't think about whether it's a woman or a man. Like, I just try to write the best characters, and I feel comfortable writing female characters. This one had an extra layer of sensitivity because of the issues involved, and I spoke to a lot of female friends of mine when I was writing the script. But I do think a tiny part of me was thinking, am I qualified to tell this story? This should be a woman director. This should be a female screenwriter telling this story. But then I met Elizabeth Moss, and she became my partner in crime. Like, she was the one who gave each scene her stamp of approval. We talked about the scenes for hours, and we would break the dialogue apart, put it back together. And she just made little additions here and there just to make it truthful. She was so generous with that, with just saying, like, oh, you see this scene here? I'm thinking this isn't quite right, that she freaks out so quickly. And I was open to it because I was worried about what you mentioned. I didn't want anybody pointing the finger at me and saying, you're not the right person to tell this story.
We're talking with Lee Whannell about his new film, The Invisible Man. People who know your filmmaking would not say you've done a lot of romantic comedy. You've done a lot of genre films. What does genre give you to tell a story about relationships and about a woman who can't escape a bad marriage?
I think the horror genre has always been an amazing Trojan horse for social issues. What is the horror genre about, right? It is about society expressing their anxieties. That's how we get our anxieties out. We go into a theater, the whole world is filled with these frightening issues. I mean, look at the world right now. All you have to do is jump online and it's coronavirus. It's, you know, North Korea building nukes. Like, it's nerve-wracking and anxiety-inducing to think about the possibility of contracting coronavirus. So I'm going to bet, let's make a bet right here, and I'll come on the show in a few years and you can call me on it, right? In the next couple of years, you're going to see a horror movie that reflects coronavirus. It'll be a heightened version of it, so it'll be this flesh-eating disease that turns people. But what the movie is about is that. And so I feel like horror movies have always done that, and I think this movie just happens to reflect this moment that we're living in.
Lee Whannell's film is called The Invisible Man. It's in theaters now. Lee, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. I am not really a big fan of the band Kiss, but I will share this little personal story. Up until very recently, I thought the lyric was, I want to rock and roll all night and part of every day because you need to get some rest. Anyway, this next story sure made me more empathic to those who love Kiss. The rock pioneers are on their goodbye tour, and it's got some of their super fans talking about their feelings. The Frame contributor Paul Ratliff, himself a lifelong Kiss fan, has our story.
So it's 1978. I am 7 years old, and I'm sitting in a giant walk-in closet in my best friend Robbie's bedroom. The closet is lit by a string of Christmas lights. He puts a needle on a record, hands me an album cover, and I hear this. Robbie points to an illustration on the album cover and tells me that a demon is singing. In that moment, I experience a kind of imprinting. Kiss instantly becomes my first favorite band, and right there, yes, in a closet, I become a lifelong member of the Kiss Army.
The hottest band in the world, Kiss!
In 1978, Kiss are the biggest band in the world. It's an era that diehards refer to as Super Kiss. There were books, magazines, a TV movie, and a merchandising campaign the likes of which the industry had never seen.
Introducing Kiss Your Face Makeup, just like the makeup worn by Gene, Paul, Peter.
In the 80s, as I struggled into my teenage years, Kiss struggled to compete with the hair metal bands of that era. In an act of self-preservation and maybe the most exciting event of my childhood, Kiss surrendered their makeup and were reborn as actual human beings.
Exclusively here on MTV this evening, we are going to see Kiss without their makeup for the very first time.
What emerged was a different kind of Kiss. This Kiss championed the underdog. They were anti-authoritarian, and they were all about self-empowerment. This is the Kiss I loved the most. As a gay kid growing up in a tiny desert military town with a homophobic father in the Reagan era, I needed this version of Kiss. And while my father was policing my clothes and my hair, Kiss was sending me a completely different set of messages. When Kiss announced they were going on their last tour ever, I had a surprisingly strong emotional response, and I started to notice that other fans were having similar experiences. So I wanted to talk to them, and I knew just the place to go. Vegas.
Right now, we are standing here in our Love It Loud Rock and Roll Wedding Chapel. So it's our Kiss Wedding Chapel. It's all themed out for rock and roll.
Michelle Vermillion is general manager of what's essentially a giant Kiss refuge inside the Rio Hotel in Vegas, where they have Kiss-themed weddings and glow-in-the-dark mini-golf.
We also, in our venue, have the largest public collection of Kiss memorabilia. So it's almost like a mini-museum right inside of our venue with tons and tons of items that Kiss fans love to check out.
And some of those fans become employees. Wyatt Allison, who is 21 years old, discovered Kiss in a video game when he was 8.
They're the most realist form of superhero that you can ask for. You know, you have Spider-Man and you have Hulk and all, which is cool and all. No one does it the way Kiss does it. You know, Gene Simmons spitting blood and Paul Stanley flying to the middle of the crowd to greet his fans. It just never gets old for a Kiss fan.
I'm the product of a bloody divorce from my parents, so I buried myself in my room and I had a lot of kids.
Glenn Rhodes is a former employee who has followed the band for over 40 years.
They were my family. My family was fighting each other and I was in my room listening to Kiss, and they got me through.
Back in the chapel, Lucy Veltri, a makeup artist, is helping a bride get ready.
Right now, I am putting on a base coat of white. And I do that with a sponge because that kind of gives it the airbrush look instead of having kind of like brush stroke streaks.
Dusty is marrying her boyfriend, Tennessee, after 20 years together. She will have Paul Stanley's makeup, white face, black star over her right eye. What inspired you to have a Kiss-themed wedding?
Our daughter has autism, and she has a huge attraction to Kiss, and she wanted to have something fun, and we wanted to do something fun for her, so that's why.
When you have that, she's come through so much. The fact that she's out here moving around, and, you know, it's all about my kid. She deserves as much life as anyone else, but yeah, Lanae.
Hi. So you're a big Kiss fan?
Yes, sir.
What is it that you like about Kiss?
The music.
A lot of people with autism aren't even vocal, but you can put music in their life and it opens up every pore of their being. That is why we're doing this today. And
you're gonna mess up your makeup. Don't cry, don't cry.
For The Frame, I'm Paul Ratliff.
It's The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Lately, when Steve Coogan shows up in movies directed by Michael Winterbottom, he's traveling around Europe with Rob Brydon, competing over who does the best, Michael Caine.
I don't want to bury you, Batman. I will not put you into the ground in a little box. I will not do it, Master Bruce. I will not do it.
I'm not going to bury another Batman.
Another Batman? How many Batmans has he been burying? How many are there? I've buried 14 Batmans
so far. I've buried 14 Batmans.
And a little pointy ears
in a
box.
I'm not going to bury another nylon cloak with pointy ears that people wear at birthday parties.
But Greed, the latest film starring Coogan and directed by Winterbottom, is a lot different from the Trip movies. It's a satire about a billionaire fashion mogul who exploits garment workers in Asia, avoids taxes in the UK, lines his family's pockets, and yet still feels he doesn't have nearly enough. In this scene, Coogan's character's mother and ex-wife have just arrived on the Greek island where he's throwing himself an over-the-top birthday party.
Lily was here, but she's gone off with the reality TV show.
Oh, what's all that about? Why would you want your life splashed all over the telly, Francois?
Beats me.
Well, I think it's pretty good for her, actually. It gives her something to do and it keeps her grounded.
Keeps her grounded?
Yeah. If you look at the Kardashians, Kylie Jenner's got over 1 billion Instagram followers. She's on the cover of Forbes.
Well, then she must be a very good person, basically.
She's richer than you, sweetie. And she's
worth
that.
That's not true, is it?
Yes, it is. It's actually
true. That can't be true.
She's richer than you.
This particular film, Michael wanted to say something about inequality. And the sort of the emergence of these new billionaire class, which has emerged over the last 20, 30 years, and seems to have escaped scrutiny somehow. And the film is an attempt to sort of shine a light on that, the huge gap between the rich and the poor, in a way by making something that's entertaining and turns funny and strange and interesting without it seeming too sanctimonious.
So what can a fiction film do that maybe a documentary can't?
Well, I think that documentaries, there's some brilliant documentaries around, but I think what a narrative can do is tell a story, tell a human story. You know, we have documentaries and we have news reports and good journalism that report facts, and most people, many people make judgments based on the facts that they accumulate, but many people don't, and they're fixed with a prejudice. And it doesn't matter how many facts and figures and statistics you present them to support your argument, if they've got a fixed prejudice, they'll stick with it. And the good thing about narrative is you tell a story, and if you tell a story and you entertain people or make them laugh or touch them or engage them on a human level, then I think you're more likely to make them think about the sort of the subtext of the film. But comedy is very useful when you're trying to tell a story, because if you're trying to talk about something that you think is important, no one wants to have a lecture. But they if they laugh, then they'll kind of relax a little, and they'll be more open to what you've got to say. And I think I would say that if you want to persuade people to question their beliefs or maybe question something they thought to be true, you either make them laugh or you make them cry. And if you do one of those two things, you're halfway to making them think twice.
When you and Michael were talking about playing this character, how did you go about figuring out what he sounded like, what he looked like, how big his teeth were? What were the components of putting this character together?
Well, you know,
he's got big teeth.
He's got very big teeth, and they're very, very white. Even by Los Angeles standards, they are very white. So we wanted to make him, in some ways, that the film is funny. It's a satire on the super wealthy. But in actual fact, the sort of super white teeth and sort of all year round perma tan and sort of blow dried hair. It might seem exaggerated. It's not really exaggerated at all. In fact, the behavior of the character, because he's pretty obnoxious and unapologetic and flamboyant and crude, his behavior is really no exaggeration at all. There are many successful people who have a bombastic nature. So we don't feel we're really exaggerating anything. But there's a lot to go, and there's lots of billionaires that you can draw upon. And many of them are quite charismatic, even if they can be quite didactic and sometimes bullying.
We're talking with Steve Coogan about his new film, Greed. The character that you play in this film is having an elaborate birthday party. There's even a subplot that involves some refugees who are camped on the beach that might ruin the backdrop for the birthday party.
Who are they?
They're camping.
What is it, Duke of Edinburgh?
Syrian refugees.
Poor things.
Well, they've come a long way. They won't mind going a bit further. Get rid of them.
Rich.
What? They're refugees. They can find refuge somewhere that isn't smack bang in the middle of our f***ing view.
It's a public beach. In Greece, all beaches are public.
It's not me. It's my guests. Some of them are very superficial.
And he's not joking.
No, he's not joking, but he sort of says it in quite a sort of an acerbic way. And the refugees, actually, by the way, were real refugees. Who played themselves, the Syrian refugees who ended up in the Greek islands having escaped from Syria. And so Michael wanted to introduce the idea of the refugees, because there's another group of people who we don't like to think about. You know, we go on holiday to these wonderful resorts. You know, people go on holiday to the Greek islands, and they know that on the island next door there are you know, tens of thousands of refugees that are stuck there and are sort of living in limbo. when we were making this movie, we spent 1 week in Monaco on super yachts that cost $150,000 a day to rent. The next week we're in Sri Lanka in garment factories where they paid $4-5 a day. Sometimes Bangladesh even less, $3.50 a day. And there's a direct relationship between the super rich and the super poor, and it's something that people don't like to draw attention to. Certainly the super rich don't, and they are often the people who control the means of communication. But really what we're doing is you don't often see those two worlds, the world of the sort of disempowered, dispossessed, in the same film as you see sort of glamour and sort of ostentatious displays of wealth. So we wanted to put the two in within the same film and bang them up against each other to make it sort of crystallize what the problem is.
How do you get the refugees and the people working in those sweatshops to participate and not exploit them as they've been exploited in the past?
Well, those who were engaged in the crew and the ones who were in the scenes were paid the same as any professional person would be paid. And of course, in the garment factory and in the garment factory, there's hundreds of people, and effectively we're making a documentary there because we're pointing a camera. So, and they're being paid for what they do. What we did do though is make a contribution to their union, their pressure group, who try to improve the living standards, for the wages of people who work in those places. So, so we made sure that we did something constructive.
I'm curious how much you knew about this inequality issue before making the film. And in making it, did it change your behavior? Because I have to say, after I watched the film, I went and started looking at the tags on my clothes to see where they were made and if they were made in Bangladesh or Sri Lanka or places that have historically bad records of sweatshop conditions.
Yes, it did. And of course, people who have the sort of economic means to make choices where they buy clothes that might be slightly more expensive but are made more ethically, that's of course something they can do. But we're not even really pointing the finger at consumers for making these choices, because almost every store operates in this way. What we're trying to do is say, have a conversation where we try and change the system, and also put it on the agenda in some way. I think it is starting to be spoken about more. You know, many things that weren't on the agenda, I'd say, 20, 30 years ago, like gender politics, diversity, the environment, these subjects that weren't really discussed are now front and centre on the news agenda. But something that until quite recently has escaped scrutiny is this huge disparity between the rich and the poor. But I think it is starting to be talked about more, and it feels like the time is ripe, especially in America at the moment. The election is something that is starting to be spoken about, and I think it's a good thing.
Steve Coogan's new movie is called Greed. It's in theaters now. Steve, thanks so much for coming in.
Pleasure.
Coming up on The Frame Weekend, a new edition of the podcast Song Exploder and an avant-garde opera that challenges our ideas of who owns the land. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. When Letizia Tamco began making her second album under the name Vagabond, she really wanted to produce the entire thing on her own, even though she didn't have a lot of experience. On the song Water Me Down, Tamco actually had a co-producer, Eric Littman. It's the one exception to her otherwise entirely self-produced album. In this excerpt from the podcast Song Exploder, hosted and produced by Frame contributor Hrishikesh Hirway, she breaks down how she and Littman produced the song and why it was worth making the exception.
Hi, I'm Letizia Tamco, and I make music as Vagabond. I was at my friend Eric Littman's house in Bushwick, New York. He is someone who has been really supportive of my journey as a producer. During the winter, every Wednesday, we would get together and make music. So we were in his very small bedroom. And the plan was to demo a Vagabond song that I had started writing a few days earlier. And then he showed me the synth line that he had started working on for another project. I heard it and I was like, oh my God, what is that? I was like, I have to have this song. And so I asked him if I can hop on it and just do some vocals. So he gave me the room for 30 minutes. And, you know, immediately I had an idea for melodies and lyrics. Oddly enough, I had just gotten off the phone with someone I was dating at the time. And it was the most infuriating phone call that I had been on in a long time. And I think I had this epiphany moment where I was like, wait, I don't need any of this. I'm not in survival mode. I don't need anything that doesn't serve me or make me feel good. I need more. I was having this conversation in Eric's room. So as soon as I got off the phone, I had just had all these things that I wanted to say to the person. And so I sat on his bed with a microphone to my mouth and I just sang the entire song. Never meant to be you, never meant to be me, never meant to be us. It was very much like I wish I said it on the phone, but I used those feelings very much in the moment, and that's why it came pouring out. I was just in it. In a time when you don't know how to communicate with someone, it has served me well in my entire career so far to put those messages that I wish I can have with people into songs. Never meant for all of this, never meant for you to love, never meant for you to trust. After that, I started to work on the drums. Eric and I made our own samples. The only electronic drum is the kick. Everything else was recorded in the bedroom. We had tracked some snare in his bedroom with brushes. On the snare, I threw in two tape delays to kind of have that like dancey house beat. The hi-hats are live hi-hats. I consider myself a student, and I've always liked electronic music, R&B music, dance music, but making it has never felt accessible. With this album, I set the intention of working on being a good producer. I wanted to have the experience of making an album be one where I'm learning something and practicing a skill. I like to have a practice. That's Oliver Hill on viola. He made this three-part harmony that's very mournful. I wanted these strings that sound sad if you isolate them. If you isolate the strings and the vocal, you have a whole different song with these lyrics that are really raw and emotional and ending. It feels like an ending. You know me better than that. You know I hate it like that. It really waters me down. But within the context of the beat, you have a whole nother world because the instrumental feels like a beginning. That is exactly what that phone call felt like. And so I really wanted to chase that. I wanted to express the triumph of feeling this thing, but not feeling like it's the end of the world. You know me better than that. You know I hate it like that. It really waters me down. You know me better than that. You know I loved you like that. It really waters me down. Water me down, it means to be diluted, like someone taking away from the pure concentration of a person. And so the way that I'm using it in the song is this really dilutes everything that is good about me. This was a very specific time in my life too, really coming into who I am going to be. And this person just didn't fit the mold. And so I had this like breakthrough moment and I wasn't sad. This was not an ending that was sad.
Do you know if the person who you were talking to on the phone ever heard the song?
I don't know for certain, but I'm positive. I'm sure of it. Almost immediately, I was like, I know he's going to hear this, so that's perfect. You know, a little petty behavior turned into a pretty good song.
You can hear a longer version of that session with the singer Vagabond at songexploder.com. It's the Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Yuval Sharon is used to being on the receiving end of some baffled looks when he tries to explain his operas. His latest piece, Sweet Land, is a collaborative open-air opera about colonialism and displacement. It's set in the L.A. State Historic Park just north of downtown.
I was hearing from my collaborators over and over again how much the relationship to land was such a crucial aspect of what they wanted to explore with this piece. And when it comes to that relationship with land, it seemed to me that one of the places that really holds so much of LA's cultural history and meaning is that sliver of land that is now the LA State Historic Park. For a long time, it was considered a brownfield, meaning that they didn't think that anything could grow on it anymore because of how terribly it was maintained during industrialization and during the railroad era. And it wasn't until Lauren Bohn came up with her Not a Cornfield project, this really bold experiment in kind of replanting the land and showing its continuous fertility. Before that, people sort of abandoned it and thinking that that was the most important Tongva village, that it was the site of this crucial Spanish settlement, that it was this floodplain. All of those things for a while were buried under layers of industrialization. And thanks to Lauren and thanks now to the park, it has this new life to it, but those layers still struggle to come out.
I want to play a clip of the music and some of the libretto from your opera. So what are we hearing here? Who are these voices and where does this fall in the story?
These are the amazing voices of three artists that are involved in the piece, three of 36 different vocal artists, in addition to 24 instrumentalists that have all made up what this piece is about. You're hearing Janine Washington as guide, Carmina Escobar as one of the coyotes, and Michaela Tobin as the other coyote. These are three characters. They form a really crucial component to what this piece is, especially Carmina and Michaela, who are two artists who have dealt a lot with improvisation and the practice of improvisation, which is something that most people don't think belong in a traditional opera. We think of opera as a very rigid, closed score. This notion that you're creating a condition for music to flow rather than just recreate a set score. And that plays a really important role in Sweetland, not just because of these three artists, but it started to be something that we opened up to the instrumentalists, to some of the other singers as well. And I think that's part of what gives this particular performance its power, is that it is something that is so of the moment. That the inspiration that all of the singers take from each other and from the ideas are all kind of set up and then allowed to just exist in that moment in time.
We're talking with Yuval Sharon about the new opera, Sweetland. So much of this story seems to be about whose land is this land? Is it ours to exploit? Is it God's gift to us? Was that something that you found yourself talking about repeatedly, about who owns what? And by owning it, is it more important to share it?
It was the topic of so many conversations. And Chinupa Hanska-Luger, who is the co-director and my kind of closest partner in so many aspects of this, you know, he said repeatedly and so, so beautifully the notion that we belong to the land, that notion of it is really what we were trying to convey with this piece. And it's something that's so contradictory to how we are told to think about the land in capitalist terms or in terms of a pure consumerism, that that we own it whether or not it's because of religious purposes. Certainly in our more secular age, the remnants of that religious fervor that made us believe that we could own the land, that we deserve the land, that the people that were here don't exist, that they're not even human. All of that thinking now has these sediments over it that have resulted in the idea that, oh, because I have the money, I deserve the land.
So much of music is spectator driven, and it's true of opera as well. How do you make sure that the spectator at Sweetland becomes a participant in the story after it's over?
We sometimes think that when pieces have a political point of view, it's meant to make us feel more like more enlightened citizens for having experienced it, and then maybe letting us feel like we've done our job because we showed up. But showing up is just the beginning of a very long process, and that includes the process that we all undertook as the creators of the piece. This is not the end of the line with this piece. This is in many ways a really, really profound beginning to what I think is going to be a lifelong reflective process for everyone.
Yuval, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, John.
For more information about Sweetland, go to theindustryla.org. And that is all we have for today. The Frame Weekend is edited and produced by Darby Maloney, along with producers Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, and Julia Paskin, with help this week from Itzi Quintanilla. Eduardo Perez is our engineer. The Frame's theme music is by Taylor McFerrin, and our senior producer is Oscar Garza. And I'm John Horn from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. Have a great weekend.